This episode is brought to you in part by Brewers Publications, the largest and most complete collection of brewing books in the world. Whether brewing is your weekend hobby or your day job, Brewers Publications is your go-to source for all things beer and brewing. Visit brewerspublications.com to browse beer books. brewerspublications.com. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, April 11th, 2019. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, Brad Coker of Sparrow Malting talks about starting up a fledgling craft malt house and tells us his process of malting grain at home. If you go to basicbrewing.com, you can find archives of our audio and video shows, our DVDs of brewers' logbooks and other Basic Brewing gear, including our tie-dye silicone pint and our brewing rainbow shirt. Right now, the shop is offline as we speak, but it's being renovated. It's being fixed. It's being updated. So stay tuned. Or check back on that, basicbrewingshop.com. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Basic Brewing and find our show page on Facebook as well. We have a cool Basic Brewing app on iTunes and Amazon.com, and we're found all over the place where fine podcasts are served up. And if you do us a favor of rating us on iTunes and maybe leaving a nice comment there, they say that that will help new listeners to find us. If you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing. And thanks to everybody who's helping out in that way. If you go to patreon.com/basicbrewing, you can see a long list of stuff that you can access if you sign up as a supporter. Steve and I shot a couple episodes of Basic Brewing video this week. Three, in fact. So it's not a couple, it's a few. And Patreon supporters will get early releases of those episodes as well as behind-the-scenes versions of a couple of them for higher-tier supporters. This week it was my No Chill Helles and my Instant Pot IPA. Both tasty beers, although I'm still having the issue of lack of head retention with the Instant Pot beer. Since it's a small batch, the bigger batches, I don't have a problem. So I think it was, I did think it was some sort of contamination, but now I'm suspecting that the detergent I've been using to clean my small fermenters is the culprit. So I've been using automatic dishwashing powder, which I've had success with in the past, but I think I'm just using too much. So, I'll put like half a scoop into a 1 gallon jug and I see it does the job, but boy, I think there may be a little bit of residue in there that's knocking the head down on my small batch beers. You know, automatic dishwashing powder has to be non-foaming, otherwise it would look like Bobby Brady was doing laundry.
Alice, the washing machine's gone crazy!
some of you will get that. The Helles is delicious and appropriately foamy, by the way. I kegged it. It was a 5 gallon batch, and it would be a great beer to put into my Poncho's keg cooler from our sponsor, Poncho's Brewing Lab. You know, warm weather is here in Northwest Arkansas, and if it's not already there where you are in the Northern Hemisphere, it's coming. And if you are frustrated with the inconsistencies and headaches of jockey boxes, Poncho's has a better option. The Poncho's Keg Cooler is a 20-gallon cylindrical cooler designed to hold 5-gallon corny kegs. The keg sits cool as a cucumber inside the cooler, and you can use the built-in tap to dispense your delicious homebrew out on the patio or the beach or wherever you're serving your beer. And right now, Poncho's Keg Cooler comes with a stainless steel retractable intertap faucet, which will close automatically after each pour. And you can customize your Poncho's Keg Cooler, including stepping up to the Pro version, which comes with a Sankey tap that can be used with a sextal or quarter barrel Sankey keg in addition to the ball lock homebrew corny. I love my Poncho's Keg Cooler. Can't wait to use it again and share my homebrew with my friends in a neat way outside. No more sweaty trash cans for my keg. And it can be converted into a 20-gallon mash tun. If you use the code BBR at ponchosbrewinglab.com, you can save 15% off a Poncho's Keg Cooler at ponchosbrewinglab.com. Another beer I have hopes for, high hopes for, is a no-chill Belgian golden ale that I brewed a few days ago. I haven't brewed a Belgian-style beer with candy syrup in a while. This one is mostly Pilsner malt with a little bit of wheat, pearly hops, and a pound of golden candy syrup at 5 SRMs. I also added half an ounce of each hop from the latest hop sampler series, Motueka, Nelson Sauvin, and Rocco. I added those at flame out and then put the wort straight into the no-chill container. So I'm really looking forward to seeing how that no-chill process affects those hops at the end of the boil. Will the long chilling time extract a lot of bitterness? Will the hop flavors and aromas come through? You have to stay tuned for that. I brewed my Belgian-inspired beer with my Warthog electric brewing setup from our sponsors Desiree and Dave from High Gravity in Tulsa. If you didn't hear last week, Desiree emailed me a couple of fun bits of news. First, High Gravity is now a retailer for Spike Brewing Gear out of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. If you go to highgravitybrew.com and look for Spike equipment, you can see an impressive collection of stainless conical fermenters that use sanitary TIG weld couplers for connecting valves, thermometers, and such, not the weldless fittings that require O-rings that will eventually need to be replaced. They use tri-clamp fittings, butterfly valves, and they really step up your homebrew game, and they look shiny and kind of sexy. Spike fermenters would go great with a Warthog electric system. Also, High Gravity is sponsoring a beer festival on May 11th that will kick off the Tulsa Craft Beer Week. It's the Tulsa Craft Beer Invitational, sponsored by High Gravity and the Fellowship of Oklahoma Ale Makers. It'll feature rare beers from Oklahoma-based breweries and homebrewing clubs. You can find out more info and get tickets by going to beerfests.com and searching for Tulsa Craft Beer Invitational. And don't forget that if you use the code EBC75BB on highgravitybrew.com, you can save $75 off your electric brewing purchase. Highgravitybrew.com. Okay, Brad Coker is on the ground floor of starting up a craft malting company here in Northwest Arkansas. He's been doing pilot batches for some of the local breweries and getting his business plans in order. And while he's been doing that, he's been perfecting his home malting techniques. So we met up at Steve's Brew Shop to pick his brain a little bit. Brad Coker, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
Thank you so much, James. Glad to be here.
We're here in the back of Steve's Brew Shop with owner and proprietor, Steve Wilkes.
Hey, James. It's a pleasure to be in my own establishment.
We're making you stay after hours.
That's right, with you guys.
But you're serving us a delicious beer here. What do we got?
Yeah, this is my take on a little German Schwarz beer. So it's pretty good, I think. I used Imperial Urkel. As the yeast, and it's just like about 8 pounds. I can't remember exactly the recipe, but it's about 8 pounds of Vienna, a half a pound of Beechwood smoked malt, a little Munich, a little wheat. You got a little Munich, you got a little wheat, and I can't remember what the hops are, but it's not very hoppy.
And what makes it black?
Oh, the midnight wheat, sorry. Yeah, and I was really surprised because I haven't used midnight wheat much in my own brewing, and so I wasn't quite sure how much to use. But I used the right amount because it's certainly black. But it only took like 6 ounces in this 5-gallon batch.
Wow.
And it's as dark as night.
Wow. Yeah, it's beautiful. Very tasty. So Brad, here we are. We got a table full of grains and such. And you are in the midst of trying to establish a small malting company. Is that right? Sparrow Malting?
That is correct.
So give us your elevator pitch. Who are you and what are you trying to do?
Well, I love local craft beer, and I have for a long time, as many people do. But a few years ago, it came to me that, you know, most local craft beer, the only local ingredient is really the water, outside of some fruits and occasional spices and things like that. And unless, of course, you live in a part of the country where there might be a lot of cereal seed grains that are, you know, maybe being malted locally. So I thought, what part can I play in helping strengthen the local craft beer scene here in Northwest Arkansas, and also strengthen the local economy by keeping more of our money here in the area, and then also really trying to make a value-added product by working with local and regional farmers and helping improve products that they either are already growing or may be willing to experiment with growing.
Mm-hmm. Got a lot of farmland around here, a lot of farmers, and be nice to be putting that into beer.
Absolutely. That's the plan.
So where are you now? I mean, what stage of the process are you as far as establishing the business?
I'm still currently doing nano batches. I think we could call a 12-pound batch a nano batch, maybe, tiny batch, basically out of a room in my house. And the next step will be trying to scale up to 1 to 2 ton floor malted batches, I think will be the most realistic step. And hopefully, once things go well with that, in the next year or two, be looking at scaling up to larger equipment, perhaps 3 to 5 ton germination kiln vessels to start doing larger batches and really be able to service the community even better.
So I know with floor malting, you probably need a floor, but what what else do you need for that first step, for that first volume that you're looking at?
Sure. We would need a steep vessel, so you can use a, you know, a cone fermentation tank. It can either be poly or stainless. Stainless would be preferred, of course. You have some different options there with temperature control, since steep water has to be maintained reasonably cool, depending on the time of year, of course. And then, of course, the floor, as you've mentioned, and I won't chase into the weeds right now about how different states determine, is it a food product, is it just a value-added agricultural product, etc. So that floor could either be a real actual floor or some type of false floor that's raised up off the floor. Outside of that, of course, you would need your kilning vessel, and that would be where some expense, of course, would come into play, because you're looking at the engineering for it, the stainless that's required for it, and then beyond that, a debearding machine and a seed cleaner. So there are some definite hardware expenses up front, but that, in short, and of course a bagging machine and baggers, but that would be the basics of getting it going.
And there, the craft malting business is growing, is it not? I mean, it seems like I hear every now and then about new to me, little maltsters around the country that are doing this thing on a smaller scale. Is that true? And is there a ready supply of equipment for small scale maltsters out there?
Yes, there are. We are seeing the rise of more craft malt houses throughout North America. I believe around 2014, I think, is about the time Dave Thomas put forth the Craft Maltster's Handbook. And in the back of that, I think that at that time there were 20 to 30 craft malt houses in North America. And I think now they're either currently in production or in the same phase that I am, probably around 100, give or take. You know, that tends to change a bit. But regarding equipment, there are two or three that I know of offhand companies in North America that have designed equipment at the craft malt scale, and a lot of those are modular systems, so you could start at one tonnage, and then you could work your way up and basically use your same basic setup in terms of your HVAC systems and things like that, and just add in modular as you want to scale up.
So now you're essentially a home maltster, right? You're doing home malting. What are you using right now as far as, and remind me how big your batches are right now, and what are you using to do that?
Okay, the batch size right now is about a 12-pound batch, and I'm doing the air quotes here, floor malting. I actually have it like under the bed storage trays that you can buy, you know, local store, just with the lid off, of course. I use that typically, those trays. They're about 4 or 5 inches deep. That's what I use as my germination vessels. And I'll either turn it with a small food grade rake, or a lot of times I'll just turn it by hand, because it's very much a hands-on process. And at this point, it's definitely a labor of love. As far as the barley goes and any other grains I'm getting right now, I have malted with some grains from South Dakota and North Dakota, and I've received some barley and wheat from Montana. And most recently, and actually what has me most excited being here in Northwest Arkansas, is from just north of the Enid, Oklahoma area. So I think that's about 240 miles from where we are right now. So that definitely would fall in the regional category. And I've picked up some two-row Went malt variety barley from them, and also some rye. So excited about that. As far as the kilning process, a lot of people might consider it a hop oast design. You know, basically just building a plywood box about 2 feet cube, and then using a screen wire and, you know, just making some inlay trays. And you just, once you go through the germination process, you lay the barley out, give it as, you know, as level as possible. And in the bottom of that box are 3 100-watt light bulbs. And depending on the internal temperature that I'm trying to get, you can just simply unscrew one of the bulbs or, you know, screw it in. Or occasionally one will burn out and you check your temperature and like, well, I'm at 120. And then 4 hours later, it's like, well, I'm at 93 degrees. And, oh, I bet I lost a light bulb. You know, so definitely the science at this level is very imprecise. But I will say I'm currently in process on my 64th batch of, you know, home malting or nano malting. And I take extensive notes. You'd be, if you can't sleep some night, I'll just be happy to text you some of those notes. But I do that because I know that once this scales up, that it's going to be that kind of level of detail and craftsmanship that I'm going to have to put into each batch to make sure it's a quality product, not local just for the sake of being local, because if it's local and bad, nobody wants that, you know. So being at a quality level that can, you know, hopefully rival some of the commercial malt houses while keeping more money in our local economy.
So you're not forcing any air or anything? It's just the radiation of the light bulbs, or how does that work?
That's a great question. I forgot that part. There are 3 small holes drilled in on one side. There's a CPU fan on top. By the way, I'm not the engineer in the family. My father, who interestingly is a teetotaler himself, but he did say he would do anything he can to help me out with this project. He built this. So we put a CPU fan on the top, and depending on, you know, what kind of airflow you want, you can turn that fan on and that starts drawing the air up from the bottom. Now, it's, you know, pretty passive in that way because it's drawing through. And, you know, once we build up and have a kiln system designed, it will have a blower on it so that you hit the CFM that you're looking for to actually be very active in drying off that grain bed. So, again, a lot of imprecision with it. But I think home brewers and some local craft brewers that have brewed with it have found that it has a nice flavor often and has, you know, something they can't, you know, quite defined, but they know it's something a little bit different. And for right now, I think the novelty of that is enjoyable, but always trying to get back to the science end of things to really move as we scale up.
Now, you've got some samples here in front of us, including something that in a yellow fluid in a mason jar that Steve and I were suspicious of at first, but and we probably both made the same joke independently. What have we got here?
Okay, so this is from the American Society of Brewing Chemists, the ASBC. This is their hot steep method. About a year or so ago at the first annual Craft Maltsters Guild conference in Asheville, North Carolina, I heard this phrase and saw this phrase in print going around, stop chewing and start stewing, or something along those lines, because I know you guys both as home brewers and many, you know, commercial brewers, you know, will chew their grains. And I think there's still, you know, there are many benefits to that, but really trying to figure out what the malt is going to do in the beer. Basically, you're making a wort. Just a malt tea. So what we have here today is Tradition Barley out of South Dakota. It's a 6-row varietal. I finished cleaning and bagging this back on February 4th, I think, of this year. So just a couple of months ago. And basically used a small coffee grinder and made it into a malt flour. And smells, you know, a lot like a malt cereal that we might have had as children. But, you know, you heat to a certain temperature and you let it steep and you drain it through a coffee filter, basically. And that's what we have here.
And this is from the malted 6-row. What do you think, Steve?
It tastes nice. It's sweet. I'm sure it would ferment. So when you did you mash it? I mean, did you actually do a, you know, like 150-degree mash for an hour or something like that to get it? Because it's got a lot of sugar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so basically it was just a short mash. Took a thermos, like a 24-ounce thermos, and yeah, I heated the water to about 150 degrees. I have a digital tea kettle and, you know, kept that temperature pretty constant there. Ground the malt and put it in the thermos and then poured 400 milliliters or so, approximately, over that, shook it up and let it sit for about 15 minutes. So really about a 15-minute mash to get us to this level.
It's very nice. It's very, like Steve said, it's sweet. It's very grainy. The grain character is very nice. One thing that you don't get when you just chew malt out of a tub, you get kind of the husk might give a little astringency in there, and I'm not getting astringency with this at all.
No, not at all. It's real pleasant. Just real pleasant tea flavor, barley tea, mm-hmm. barley sugar. I almost want to sweeten my coffee with it.
Yeah, that'd work. You've been working with local breweries already on some very small projects, right?
Yes, that's correct. A couple of years ago, White River Brewing out of Springfield, Missouri, did a Kolsch style, and they just did about a 5 or 10 gallon batch, and it worked really well. And the head brewer was excited about it. And one of the most humbling experiences to date that I've had was sitting at the bar and hearing patrons talk about that beer, mm-hmm. Knowing that really the skill and the artistry of the brewer put that together. But, you know, I was very happy. And for me, that was, you know, one of those kind of tingly moments where I thought, hey, I think I've played a little bit of a role in the local craft brew scene. And that really was, I think, kind of the bug that really got me going to try to keep on keeping on.
Well, you can't you can certainly make bad beer with good ingredients, but you you can't make good beer with bad ingredients. So I think you deserve to take some credit for that. So walk us through. It's been a long time since we've done a show on home malting. So while I've got you here, while with your expertise in this area, I want to pick your brain and, you know, if people want to malt their own malt at home, especially if they want to get away from, you know, barley, if, say, they want to do some gluten-free grains or things like that, you know, maybe that, you know, they want to take it upon themselves to malt, do their own malting. Take us through the steps. I mean, what do you have to do to get the process started?
Okay, so the first thing you have to do is have a great grain source. And that really is the, you know, that's the big thing, because you can learn to malt, but if the grain that's coming to you is not quality grain, then you're in trouble. And that's something that was preached to me, so to speak, early on when I was trying to get into this. So
can you just go down to the farmer or the farmer's co-op and get, you know, feed grain for cattle? Or
Well, that's funny you should ask that, because the very first probably 15 batches of malting I did, I went to a local, it was up in Missouri, farmer's exchange, and paid way too much for a bushel of barley. And when I asked the lady that worked there, I said, do you know if this is 6-row or 2-row, or do you know what the varietal is? She said, it's barley. I said, okay, I'll take it. And because, you know, several years ago I had seen somebody on a YouTube clip malt with feed barley, and I thought, well, what the heck? This, you know, I don't have any other barley sources right now. So I malted it. The germinative energy and capacity was quite low, so a lot of the kernels didn't germinate. So by the time it came to brew something with it, it was, you know, fairly dextrin. Yeah, I mean, a lot of residual sugars and sweetness there, and, you know, maybe a bit of the starchiness, but really, it made a drinkable beer. It fermented out. I think we started with just a simple pale ale or IPA, and it hit somewhere between 5% and 6%. So it is true that, yes, you could use feed-grade barley. I know if any other craft maltsters who are up and running hear me say that, that maybe is a little blasphemy at some level in the craft malting community, but you can do that. But obviously, it's ideal when you're looking at particular protein contents and, you know, certified grain even. You know, people that can say this grain has been grown on this ground for a few years now, and it's quality, and we keep it well-conditioned. And that's the tricky part. You mentioned gluten-free grains. I'll speak to that, as my wife recently, about a year and a half ago. And at that time, she was into double IPAs. I mean, the hoppier, the better. And she loved some craft beer and found out that she had a very high gluten sensitivity. Wow. And so we have been on the search for various gluten-free beers, and so that is something that I do consider. But you're looking at, of course, at quinoa, amaranth, millet, buckwheat, and so far I haven't had luck finding local or regional farmers who are growing those items. I'm sure I could. Just to this point, it's, you know, or at least in the Ozarks here, wheat and rye people have heard of. They've heard of some barley, but typically not in the type of, you know, numbers or quality that we've been looking at recently. But I hope that, you know, when things get up and running, we can maybe help drive that. Maybe get some farmers who otherwise wouldn't be willing to take the chance, you know, because they know, well, I can grow beans and corn pretty well idiot-proof, and you're asking me to kind of grow a boutique crop here, you know, so...
Now, so you get a good source of good quality feed or seed grain.
Yes.
Because it's got to be able to sprout.
Yes. Yeah, that's correct. And some of the grain that I got from South Dakota that I mentioned a couple of years ago, it was actually tagged with the certified seed tag of, you know, what its germinative energy, what its germinative capacity is. And I won't get way into the weeds of that, but a maltster will look at very high numbers in that so that you get a high percentage of the kernels actually sprouting and germinating. So are you ready for me to kind of take us through the steps?
Yeah, you bet.
How that works? Okay. So when you have your good grain source, the first thing you want to do is start your steeping or soaking process. Usually when the barley gets to the maltster, it's anywhere 10 to 15% moisture content. And typically with barley, you want to soak that up to take it up to about 40 to 45%. Again, I won't get into the science of that and the apparatuses that can be used, for measuring moisture content. But you
can simply use a scale, right? I mean, as far as just weighing the grain and see how much water it's taken up?
Yeah, I have done that, and that works, you know, at a very small home malting scale. Yeah, that works. So really for me, I've just done several trial and error attempts at, you know, how many... There are three steep cycles, typically. How long do I steep in each of those cycles? And I have found what really works for me is very basic and very mathematically simple, as long as you know you're going to be home at those times. Steep one for 8 hours, then let it air rest. So you take it out of the water, let it air rest for about 8 hours, and then steep two for 8 hours, air rest number two for 8 hours, steep three for 8 hours, and then I let it air rest again in the same vessel before I pour it out on the floor. So, you know, really it's about a 48-hour process, and I think, you know, unless I'm very mistaken, I think even at the large scale malting operations, you would probably find something similar. There are some different techniques they can do that kind of compress that time a little bit. There might be some argument made about how that may or may not affect grain quality or taste quality at some level, but that's the steeping process.
And is temperature important at that point?
Yeah, it is. You know, typically steeping and germinating at higher temperatures will happen faster, but then sometimes that won't necessarily get out of the grain through the biochemical processes what it is that you're actually wanting. Again, I won't dig into that too far. Typically, I try to keep my water around 60 degrees. And, you know, depending on the time of year and depending on the room of the house where I'm able to keep the steep vessel, it may range anywhere from 55 degrees up to 65 or 70. There, you know, in the warmer months, if the room I'm using in the house tends to get pretty warm, I'll change the water out more often. That is one thing I do need to go back. Usually on that first steep, it's pretty important to change the water a few times during those first 8 hours, particularly after like hour one or hour two, because those grains, when they'll basically, you know, start putting off enough carbon dioxide and they'll use up all the oxygen in the water. And at that point, the embryo and the barley kernel can actually die, and you don't want that. Huh. So that's an important aspect of the process. At the end, you know, larger scale level, either through a craft malt house or an industrial strength, you know, or a commercial strength malt house, they actually have aeration systems. So if you're looking at like a cone steep tank, they'll have aeration systems typically in the bottom that will shoot compressed oxygen, usually with like a regenerative blower or something, up in there, and then also rousing, you know, get the grains moving so that they're not just compacted against each other.
And so you got your grains steeped in those three different cycles, and you've got them spread out on the floor or in your tubs, as you have. So what happens next? I assume that, that Mother Nature takes over at that point.
Yeah, the germination process really kicks in. At the end of the steeping process, you'll see what's called chitting, C-H-I-T. The chits.
It's a family show.
Yes, of course. And the chitting, if it's done well, the majority of the kernels will have that little white tip, and that is the shoot starting to the rootlets starting to come out. The shoot is actually inside the kernel. And when you feel you're at a proper level of chitting, then you can spread it out, and germination really, really takes over. So once the water is soaked into the, you know, proper level of moisture, that's when you start having the biochemical changes inside, and the enzyme production starts, and that starts beginning the process of degrading some of the protein matrix that's in there, and really starts setting the course for eventually what will be in the brew house, have the starches in such a way and the enzymes ready so that they can start tackling smaller starches and turn those, of course, into fermentable sugars. Usually about every 4 to 8 hours, I will try to turn the grain, and often I will spray it. But I have found in home malting, just, you know, taking a bottle of water and spraying it about every time I think about it. What gets a little tricky is the overnight hours. There have been times I've gotten up pretty early to do it. I typically don't wake myself up at 2 a.m. just to go turn the grain. And I have found it can go about 8 or 9 hours and usually be okay. What you have to watch out for is around day 3, because the germination process is exothermic. And now we're a science show, a science family show, right? And it starts putting off heat. And I have really noticed about day 3, if I put my hand in the bottom of the grain bed that's really only about 2 inches deep at that point, it's considerably warm. So I've had to get a little fancy with how I do that. Some of those ice packs that come when you order food products through the mail, we have some of those in the freezer, and I'll like put those out in glass trays and put them under the floor, just to try to cool things down. I usually lay a blanket across it so it doesn't get ice cold in there, but it's been fun. It's always a science project trying to figure that out. Usually the first 2 or 3 days of germination, I found you have this really lovely cucumber smell. Lovely if you like cucumbers. Mm-hmm. But that's usually a good sign of healthy germination, healthy grain. Your temperature is staying such that you're not starting to get, you know, moldy or sour smells. Now I think of it, I'm very fortunate that in my 64 batches that I've done, I've really only had one batch that soured a bit on me. And I've got to think it was pretty warm in the house, and either that, and I just, you know, maybe I didn't keep the grain turned often enough. So that is something that can happen. But if you try this at home and you get that cucumbery smell, and then you can start moving toward day 3 and 4 of germination with no off smells. And I also usually will taste the kernels throughout, you know, and if you've eaten anything bad in your life, something that was spoiled or soured, you would pick up on those sorts of things typically.
Yeah, it seems like you'd keep the product moving in order to keep the moisture level consistent throughout the whole thing, and so you don't get pockets of heat or mold or whatever in there. So it seems like a fairly labor-intensive part of the process, but I would think with a 10 or 12 pounds of grain, it wouldn't be that big of a deal.
Right. When I go into turn, it usually takes me 3 to 5 minutes. So it's not a tremendous amount of time each time that I go in to turn that. Really, a lot of the labor is mental labor, thinking through the math, you know, because with my day job, I keep a fairly busy schedule like most people do. And sometimes we have evening events or weekend events. And I really, the whole process start to finish from starting steep one to cleaning and bagging the grain is about an 8-day process, 7.5 to 8 days. And I will have to think 8 or 9 days out, map through what I am doing for that next week, because I'm really committed to, you know, trying to make the grain great. And you can do a good job with this at home without keeping such a regimen like I do, but I really try to stay on it.
And how long does it take in this stage of the process, and how do you know you're done?
That's an excellent question. It's actually one of my favorite little experiments to always go through. Inside the grain, we have the shoot or the acrospire, and kind of a ballpark idea is when that starts growing out toward the tip of the grain, usually when it's full length of the grain, you're well modified. Mm-hmm. You know, I've seen different percentages, and depends on if you're trying to make a Pilsner malt or trying to go for a typical base malt, a pale ale malt or a pale malt. I usually try to go around 90 to 100% of Acrospire growth. So you turn the kernel over to the smooth side and you just break it between your thumbnails and you can see where the Acrospire is. And I've done it long enough now that after day one, I typically don't check anything. Day two, I don't check anything unless it's a new variety. Like this first batch I did with this Oklahoma-grown grain, I did after day two, and I wanted to look and see where the Acrospire was, and it was about 50%. And I thought, well, we're spot on. But I did find this particular varietal by about day three, some Acrospires were pushing up to 75-90%. And early on day four, I was close to the end of the grain. I mean, almost full growth. And I thought, hey, I've got to get this in the kiln. You know, previous grains that I had done, I could go full 4 days. This was about 3 2/3, which really does make a difference because, you know, if you get what are called overs or hussars, I think is one of the technical terms for it, and the Acrospire actually goes out the grain, then you're starting to move a little more into like a vegetal, you know, kind of off flavor that you're not really you don't want in your beer.
You're getting salad then.
Yeah. who wants that?
So then, once it's fully modified, and that's a term that we use in the, you know, or that we hear when we start learning about brewing. But once the malt is fully modified or modified to the level that you want, mm-hmm. now's the time to stop that process.
Right, and so basically, you have the enzymes where you want them and where the brewer's going to need them, and you've had enough starch and protein degradation in the grain that it's ready to go. So as you know, as you've said, how do we stop that? We basically push pause on that process, and that's when you put the grain into the kiln. I load it up. Right now I typically use 3 of the 4 trays that are available in my kiln box, and I just take a household fan, one of those small, about 9-inch circular fan. I put it under the bottom. I turn all 3 light bulbs on. And with that fan running under the bottom, at that point, I am actually pushing forced air through it. That goes into what's called the free dry phase. Sometimes you might hear it called withering. It's basically, you're not super heating the grain in any way. You're, you know, getting up 90 to 100 degrees, at least from my experience, that's how it's going. And just really trying to dry it off, because when you do that, it starts getting the moisture out pretty quickly. On top of the CPU fan, I have taken like a coffee tub lid and put on there just to kind of see how much moisture I collect. And I've gotten to where in that free dry phase, it's completely off. Because if not, you'll just see the moisture just drip, drip, drip. And I learned that very early on not to do that. But for me, it's a fairly non-scientific but easy way to see visually if even when I start getting into the kilning or curing phase, if there's still some residual moisture, I can put that lid on and periodically look at it. And if there are some moisture bubbles, then the free dry phase wasn't quite sufficient. So I'll take the lid off and, you know, ramp up again and try to get the air through. So for me, free dry takes about 24 hours. And then that's when I take the big fan out of the bottom. I actually lower another tray in, and I use 3 pieces of aluminum foil on that bottom tray placed so that they cover the bulbs. Because I have found that some of the trays, as they sit closer to the light bulbs, you know, it creates hot spots because, again, it's, you know, it's not at a scale or, you know, commercial strength or properly engineered, really. So that kind of shields some of that radiant heat that you're going to get from the light bulbs themselves. And then once I'm in that phase, and actually even during the free dry, about every 4 to 8 hours, I swap the trays. Yeah. You know, I'll move the middle one to the bottom one to the top, and I keep tabs on all that so I know which tray went in first, which tray was on the bottom first, because I have found that has really made a difference. I've had some batches, and that's been something from replicability that has been a challenge of, okay, these 2 trays, the malt has a good chew texture, you know, it's friable, it's able to be chewed pretty easily, and that tray I could almost break a tooth on. Mm. So something's not right. I've basically cooked the husk at that point. So the system I have now in place of swapping the trays out really avoids that, but it's definitely been some trial and error.
I think with my small batch, and like I say, I think I only did like 1/2 pound, so I think I just used a food dehydrator. Mm-hmm. You know, spread the malt out on that, and that seemed to work pretty good.
Sure. Yeah, and I've heard that's one way that is recommended. in the, if I can talk about books here, I assume that would be okay. And I know he wouldn't mind the advertisement, but John Mallett has written, you know, as part of the craft brewing series with malt and yeast mm-hmm. and hops, and he did the book on malt, and he includes, I'm sorry, I can't remember the author that he utilized, but he tags at the end of his book on malt, basically another author's, you know, spelling out of a good operation to go through for some home malting. And they mention food dehydrator or your oven. Mm-hmm. You know, oven gets a little tricky. Well, one, because you're running it for a considerable amount of time, and you really have to know your kiln schedule, because if you want to cook something, you know, you take that kind of equation out. But yeah, I've known other people that have used food dehydrators and had good success there.
Also, I don't think my oven goes that low. I mean, I can't remember what the lowest setting, maybe 250 or something like that, and you don't want to try to dry your malt out at 250 degrees.
No.
So once you're all dried out do you weigh the malt again to try to figure out what your moisture content is, or how do you figure that out?
At this point, I haven't really done that. I really just kind of go by the friability, and I haven't dropped $7,000 on a friabilimeter. But so I just really, you know, to the tooth, how is it, you know, texture-wise against my tooth? And, you know, if I feel that that's in a pretty good place, you can also take it and smash it, you know, and see, or, you know, try to pinch it apart with your fingers. You get a pretty good idea. Typically for me, if the moisture content is still a little high, I will notice some kind of vegetal kind of qualities to it, like that husk isn't quite crisp. So, you know, really it's just a very tactile way for me. I haven't, you know, I just haven't invested the time to try to do the moisture content test. Obviously, that is something in a scale up that would be done, would have to be done.
And again, you want to make sure this is dry enough, because you might, again, get a mold problem if you're not careful.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I think just that one batch that I mentioned, maybe souring or molding, again, I think it was just, you know, the moisture was off. But so far, I haven't had a problem with that. And I've tried to save back a few little samples of some malt that I even did a year ago. And occasionally I'll taste that. And, you know, the friability is still good. And, you know, one thing, of course, you know, one thing brewers talk about is slack malt. You know, when the malt has taken on some kind of ambient moisture from the room, like the malt has just set in house too long. Because obviously, like in a brewery, you have moisture around you all the time, and on brew days, you know, very hot and humid. So that is something that thankfully I haven't had an issue with, but it's probably because I'm hyper vigilant about it. And that's always one of the biggest things with this project that's coming up that hopefully we'll talk about soon. That's one thing I asked the brewer. They actually had to delay when they were going to brew this pilot batch. And I said, okay, how long is this going to be sitting around? Because I, you know, at this point, I don't have the three-layer bags and all, you know, the bags that the big malt houses use to really keep it secure. And I said, just be aware that when you go to crush this, if it's pulled on any ambient moisture from the room, you know, I'm just giving you a heads up, because at this point, you know, I'm not charging you a dime for this. We're not up in business yet. And I said, I just want you to experiment with it. And I ran into him last week and I said, okay, how did, and he said, it crushed beautifully. It was fantastic. And he said, I hit all the numbers, you know, with Play-Doh and everything. So I was really excited to hear that.
So let's finish out the process. I mean, once you've got a little bowl of malt here, and it's got little calamari legs on it here. It's got little sprouts, little rootlets on the end. You don't want that in your beer.
No, you definitely don't want the rootlets, or you'll sometimes hear it culms. Yeah, those can definitely produce some off flavors that are not desirable. So the process I go through, well, first of all, I can tell you this. I have had many a barley splinter in my hand, until I realized I probably need to cover my hands if I'm going to do this by hand. And then I, you know, I've tried several different processes. I put it in a, you know, a plasticware bowl with a lid, and I've shaken it. And, you know, I've tried several different things. I put on some, like, really thin gloves, like kind of glove liners, a couple of layers of those, and I've rubbed it between my hands. And that's worked pretty well. Sometimes still doesn't get the grain quite as clean as I would like. And then I remember reading something, and it was in John Mallett's book, again, this section about malting at home, that said, put it in a pillowcase. shake it around, beat on it, you know, because barley's pretty sturdy like that, and you're not going to hurt it. And I have found that that process actually works really well. Huh. So that is how I am currently cleaning my batches. Once I get that to a pretty clean level, I actually take one of the trays out of the kiln, pour a certain amount of barley on there, and then I shake it. And that kind of acts as, you know, it continues to break off and clean the seed a bit. So, and before I take anything to a local or home brewer, or, you know, I'm very thorough about the cleaning process to try to help that flavor profile be as good as possible.
Yeah, I'm assuming this is some of your product, mm-hmm. and it's nice and clean. Beautiful.
Yeah, there's no stems or seeds that you don't need.
That's another craft product that's getting started in Arkansas.
Coming our way.
Now, you've got an event. This is going to, quote-unquote, air next Wednesday. So you've got an event coming up this coming Saturday with New Province.
Yes, that's correct. On Saturday, April 13th, New Province Brewing Company and Rogers they've teamed up with me to do a pilot blonde ale with some of my base malt, and I spoke with Court Castleberry, the head brewer there, last weekend at the third anniversary, and he, not to give too much away here, but just made a little bit of a teaser. He said, "Well, I by the time I got everything transferred, it was about a 10-gallon batch," and he said, "So I took five to do that straight ahead, no nonsense blonde ale, so we can really see what your malts are doing, and then I've taken 5 gallons to." We'll have some fun with.
Oh,
and
wow.
So I'm really looking forward to that. So when last they gave me some details of what it might be, they're thinking in this grain-to-glass event is maybe doing a flight of 4 or 5 beers, 3 being some of their in-house staples, probably nothing barrel-aged or heavier or huge or overly hoppy, but just some straight-ahead, some of their typical varieties and offerings, and then 1 or 2 made with Sparrow malt, so that those who order that flight can really have an opportunity to see, you know, 1, if they're tasting some flavor differences from the malt, or 2, if they feel, no, this tastes like great beer to me, which is what I'm hoping for. But then I also hope there is that little, you know, that lanyap, am I saying that right? You know, that little something extra that might be in there. I also hope, as we've done today, the sensory method, I hope to have several different options there for them to taste. What I'd like to do is sensory method with some of their base grains that they typically use, and then some sensory method with my base malt. So the patrons that are there that day can, especially the grain geeks, you know, they can really have the opportunity to taste through what the malts bring into the table.
Yeah, it's fun. It's fun to taste the ingredients. It's fun to watch people kind of, you know, you have people back in your grain room, Steve, and people reach in and taste a little bit of each batch, and you know, and it really, it's fun when people get to know their food.
Yeah, and they can exactly taste the difference between tin Levibon crystal and brown malt and Vienna malt. A lot of times I just get a bowl and some sugar and milk and just, you know, tell them to, if they're here early enough.
Well, that's when you have the breakfast buffet.
That's right. It's usually every Saturday from 8 to noon.
And you have the omelet station.
That's right. We keep that by the extracts. So, you know, and then the salad bar is out by the hops. But you got to be careful because it can get bitter. Better in a hurry.
All right. Well, this has been fun. Steve, have you got any questions?
Well, I have a lot of questions, actually. So I'm sitting here thinking about this as a grain retailer and thinking about what opportunities, because I believe in farm-to-table as well, and I believe in local products as well. Unfortunately, there aren't many local products in our line of work. So the idea that there might be an opportunity to sell locally malted, if not locally grown, grain is kind of exciting to me. So then, of course, I have all kinds of questions about production schedules and availability and reliability. If you take on a product and you begin to promote the product and invest in it in terms of a space in your store and space on your website and all that, you want to make sure that you can have that product over a period of time and that your customers can get familiar with it. So those are the kinds of things that I'm sitting here thinking about. It's like, okay, how can we do this? So I'm excited about that. And then I was also curious, because I don't know much about this, but I always think about barley as being a cold weather I think of it as Scotland and the Dakotas and Calgary. I don't think of it as Enid, Oklahoma, which is like 180 degrees. So, but I did have a young lady call me, a grad student from Oklahoma State call, and they were doing a project trying to determine the viability of using Oklahoma grains and developing an Oklahoma malting industry. And so she was just doing a survey of, you know, would I as a retailer be interested in carrying that product? And I said, sure, as long as it's viable and repeatable and obviously of good quality, then yeah, sure. So I don't sure I have a question about that, except for I just don't think of the grains and the hops as an Oklahoma, Arkansas product agriculturally. Sure. But that shows you how little I know about it.
Well, not yet. You don't. But so I think Steve probably has a lot of the concerns that the brewers have. You know, sure. Of making sure that they have a product that they can depend on. That they, if they use it, you know, batch after batch after batch, they're going to get a similar result. And I'm sure that, you know, as you ramp up and you know, get your facilities and dial in your processes and all that, that's going to be at the forefront.
Right. Yeah, and those are all great concerns. And, you know, over the last couple of years when I've had the opportunity to talk to brewers, that has been their question. But honestly, several of them that I've talked to, they like the aspect that, you know, if 1 year it's this varietal and 3 years from now it's this varietal, and there are some flavor differences in that they might be willing to not necessarily build one of their brands that they take to a canning line around, but they might say, hey, this is, you know, the NWA local for quarter number one of this year. They'll have a much fancy, you know, better marketable name for it than that. But just letting the patrons know, like, hey, this is, you know, local regionally grown grain malted locally here. And some of the variants that you taste from this batch to what we do in quarter two of this year, you know, may be very, you know, minimal difference, or it may be considerable. One big thing is, you know, the opportunities that we have through Hartwick College out of New York and Montana State University. And there are a few other places, I think, coming up in the country where malt houses do send off their batches, and that's where we can come back and hand the brewer, you know, the list of 15 or 20 things of the certificate of analysis. So if nothing else, you know, if their teeth and their tongue tell them one thing, the paper that they get, right, for those who dig deep, and many of them, of course, do, as they should, into the math side of things and the science side, they'll understand, you know, the product that they're getting. And just to mention one quick thing here to give you a little idea of scale, because, you know, part of me in trying to get into this, I mean, it's a business. I mean, this is an entrepreneurial endeavor. You know, I want to, you know, want it to be a lucrative business. But when I started looking at, okay, how much grain could I actually sell here? So I spoke with a brewery in Springfield, Missouri, one of the larger ones up there, and I asked their head brewer, I said, how much base malt do you use in a year? He said, I think I've got the figures for 2017. Let me look. Just north of 1 million pounds. And if originally a year ago back in Springfield, if we had been able to get into business doing a 6-ton batch system, that's about 6 tons a week, our annual output would not have served half of that brewery's annual need. So in terms of it making business sense for our company with Sparrow, we don't necessarily need a brewery that's going to try to replicate the same beer, take it to can for the next 5 years. Right. You know, and obviously there are goods and bads on that, but for me, I think really the draw will be, hey, it's grown here, it's malted here, it stays here. And so at least that portion of the craft brewing economy in this area, you know, can be built up around that.
Right. Well, very cool. Brad, this has been fun, and I wish you luck on your endeavor, and I hope that you get to ramp up soon.
Thank you. I appreciate this opportunity. Always love to talk about malt, and if there's anybody out there in Northwest Arkansas that, you know, has some warehouse space that they would want to work with me on, I might have a project to get involved.
There you go. We can put you in touch. And thanks for your time, Steve, and your space.
As always, it's a great pleasure.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Well, thanks again to Brad and to Steve, as usual, of stevesbrewshop.com. If you're in the area and have some space that would be a good home for a craft maltster, drop me a line and I can get you connected with Brad. I'd like to see him on his way. I think it should be a really fun thing to have access to locally malted malts. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to James at basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page. Special goodies coming your way. Check all that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. It's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our websites provided by Kelly Dotson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.